Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies Markets Show. I'm John Heumann, the editor of the Investors Chronicle. I'm joined today by Ian Smith, who is the deputy companies editor and this week the news editor.
Hi John, how you doing?
Not too bad, yourself?
Too bad.
Good. I'm joined by Daniel Liberto as well. How you doing, Daniel?
Very well, thanks John.
And you've written a cover feature this week.
That's right.
On the cars.
Yep.
Subject dear to my heart of late, because I've bought a new one. And we'll talk all about that in a minute and the wonderful things my car can do and how investors can make money from this amazing advancement in technology in the automotive industry. And over in the control room, Graham Davis. How are you doing, Graham?
Hello, John. Very well. Thank
good.
You.
Good. It's been a while since you've been on the desk.
I know. It feels like ages, but yeah, I'm glad
to be
back.
You remember how to do it?
Just about.
Good.
Yes.
Okay. So, what's been going on this week? Busy week on the banking front, Ian.
Busy week on the banking front. The big news was HSBC considering a move.
Are they really, though?
I mean, are they really? Well, Hong Kong is one of the places that's been talked about. But I think I read a stat that HSBC's balance sheet was 9 times the GDP of Hong Kong. So, yeah, it'd be a huge bank to be kind of travelling there. Very big stress on the regulator.
But it's from there. I mean, this is where it began its corporate life, really.
But the kind of regulatory fines that were, and costs that it would have to move, some people think it's just saber-rattling. The HSBC itself pointed to kind of regulatory and structural reforms since the financial crisis, which is probably a euphemism for talking about the kind of litigation and conduct charges. And we've seen a lot of that this week. So today, RBS said that a further £856 million it had set aside for litigation and conduct charges. Yesterday, Barclays, £800 million on foreign exchange and £150 million on PPI compensation that was set aside in the first quarter. So it's just ongoing woes for the banking sector.
But that's not a surprise. I mean, we've written about the banking fines and the potential for more for some time. And, you know, we've known for a while that more fines, more redress was on the way. So,
but if you look at the way the share prices responded today, I think the size and yesterday, some of the sizes of those extra one-off costs have kind of surprised the market a little bit. We knew those fines were coming, but the fact that they're still so sizable has been ripe for debate. And, you know, it's probably leading to some of this discussion about where's the most cost-effective place to be headquartered at the moment for HSBC. Standard Chartered have said it's also something that bank is keeping under review. Although they've said that's not really a change in their position, but it's something that they do keep under review. So this big question of where's the most profitable or cost-sensitive place for a bank to be operating or headquartered.
There's also, sorry to butt in here, Ian, I mean, is there not a political element to this?
There's an election coming
up. We're in an election campaign. The banks like to throw their weight around, and quite often in the run-up to election, we see these sort of threats, saber-rattling to try and, you know, influence.
Yeah, definitely right. And we've seen, you know, politicians falling over themselves to say that they're going to be tough on the banking sector. George Osborne said in the budget, it's time for banks to pay their fair share. Obviously, Labour Party, led by Ed Miliband, have been very kind of talking tough on the big banks, saying we want to create at least 2 new challenger banks, further break up the banking market. The rises in the banking levy, so the increases in the banking levy have really been seen as kind of forcing some of these banks to reconsider things. So it's not a great time to be a big UK bank. You know, the tough times continue.
I mean, there's 2 things you've mentioned. So tax is one, because as far as I understand it, if HSBC were to relocate its headquarters to Hong Kong, there is a massive, massive tax saving that it could potentially generate there.
Yeah, that's one argument. There are some, I read earlier that there might be some kind of exit costs of it leaving from the UK, put on it by UK regulators. Stephen Wilmot, the company's editor this week, has written its Taking Stock column about HSBC, talking particularly about costs and saying that the cost-to-income ratio, which is a key measure of efficiency for banks, has actually risen, which is not a good thing for them, and is quite high compared to other banks in the sector. So it's saying that cost management is something the bank needs to look at. So perhaps that's a factor in there, if they can reduce their costs by moving to Hong Kong. And so do that.
Okay. Was it not a couple of weeks ago HSBC were threatening to move to Birmingham?
I think they offered to open an office in Birmingham, but I don't know if they were threatening to actually move the centre of their operations there.
Yeah, this is a bit more drastic, I guess.
Yeah, potentially.
Mm. Okay, so banks, tough times continue there. I mean, in terms of the underlying trading for banks, that seems to be pretty steady. I mean, Barclays... Yes. Underlying business seems to be doing okay.
Yeah, its adjusted pre-tax profits were up 9%, I believe it was. So that recovery story is still there. So yeah, you're right. It's not time to kind of hold your hands up and worry too much yet.
And that was one of our tips of the year this year, and it's doing okay so far.
Yeah. Exactly right. But it's not just UK banks. Obviously, Deutsche Bank paid this record settlement to US and UK authorities for over allegations around LIBOR manipulation. So that was $2.5 billion, I believe, that they had to pay. So it's not just the UK. And there are good arguments that this kind of recovery story is still there for Barclays. RBS have probably got a bit of a tougher time, but at the moment, we still think that that restructure is progressing really as expected reasonably.
Let's go back to the point about Miliband's desire to create more challenger banks. The sector seems to be doing all right in that respect already. And what does he want to happen that isn't already happening?
Yeah, it's heavy on rhetoric and light on detail, as perhaps to be expected. In terms of breaking up banks, I've had one banking analyst saying to me, it's much easier to create a new bank than it is to break away a bank from an old bank because of the infrastructure and the cost of doing that and the complexity of doing that. So it's definitely easier said than done, saying, oh, you know, we're going to break up the banking sector. As you say, all the benign credit environment means times are very good for challenger banks, as we've discussed on a couple of occasions.
You've read about several of them in the past few weeks, and they're offering loans to small businesses, offering loans for car finance, which is something that we'll potentially come on to later, Daniel.
We've tipped a couple of these as well. Ian, I think himself has.
And we always have this chart of the week in here looking at consumer credit, and they've got some data that Graham pulled together for us. And it just shows that appetite for consumer credit is increasing all the time. So there's definitely the challenger banks set to benefit from that.
Okay. Appetite for consumer credit is increasing, but there's been some signs this week that economic growth is perhaps losing some steam.
Yeah, exactly. A couple of disappointing figures for Q1. Growth of the UK economy grew at just 0.3% in the first quarter. And I think particularly construction fell. Financial services growth of that slowed. So the US also disappointed with 0.2% growth. I think the strength of the US dollar was suppressing exports there. A couple of key economic
indicators. The US figure was a big surprise, wasn't it? The markets really took fright at that yesterday, didn't they?
Yeah, definitely. That was just as we were going to press. Mm. It was quite big news.
Mm. Mm. Well, it might have been a surprise to some, because there's been a lot of talk about the strength of the US economy and how that may feed through into imminent rate rises. And we've been kind of sceptical of that argument. Mm. And I think we've been right to be sceptical of that argument. It doesn't come as a massive surprise to me that US growth has perhaps not been as one directional, uniformly powerful as perhaps previous figures have suggested.
But exactly right. Just further pushes back expectations of a rate rise in the US.
Yeah, and we do. Like, I mean, feels like a bit of a game to me.
We've questioned a few times whether, you know, this sort of mega bull run in the dollar, that was going to hurt at some point. And it looks like the past quarter it has begun to hurt. Exports are well down. You know, the strong currency does come back to bite you in the end.
Yeah, and absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, traffic does not move in one direction forever.
No.
There you go. Okay. What else we got in the news this week? Some goings on in British boardrooms. Whitbread.
Yeah, Whitbread's chief executive, Andy Harrison, is stepping down. We've written about Whitbread's results this week in the company's section. And really, he's left behind a company that's doing very well. Obviously, the two main businesses we associate with Whitbread that drive the profits are Premier Inn and Costa. Mm. And both are doing well. Both are expanding. And there have been some rumours that Whitbread might sell Costa, but we really see no reason why they should do that. Costa is a business that provides a huge amount of revenue for them, huge amount of growth, and without Costa in there, really, company's editor Stephen Wilmot said to me earlier that they perhaps should just rename themselves as Premier Inn. I mean, what else would be left in terms of sizable businesses in that group?
Having said that, I mean, in the past, so British Gas being a great example, companies have created a lot of value by splitting themselves up. And so, you know, if you've actually got two very strong businesses within one, Premier Inns and Costa Coffee, there is potentially an argument in terms of creating shareholder value that they may be better off as entities in their own right. Mm. But there's one business we like in Whitbread, isn't there, Gro?
Tay Barnes.
Yes. I so want to go to a Tay Barnes.
I've never actually been to one, but yes.
Do you know Tay Barnes?
I don't.
Oh, Tay Barnes. It's basically an all-you-can-eat buffet for a very small amount of money. And where's the
very large amount of food?
What did we work out the nearest one was? Coventry, isn't
Coventry,
it?
I think, Coventry. From here, yeah. They tend to be dotted around the north.
Anyway, no, Whitbread's interesting. another chief exec who's had some trouble this week, Sainsbury's, Mike Coop.
Mike Coop has been sentenced by an Egyptian court to a 2-year prison sentence over some business dealings that go back 14 years. And he wasn't actually at the company at the time, which seems particularly unjust.
It's mad. As we say, we're looking at his picture. There is a master criminal, if ever I saw one.
A criminal mastermind with a name badge.
With the name badge. Hello, I'm Mike. Okay. Poor Mike. I'm sure.
I don't think he'll be holidaying in Sharm El Sheikh this summer, though, will he?
No, never mind. Never mind. Okay, so what else we got on 7 days? Shenanigans going on in the Greek government. So Varoufakis has been shuffled to one side.
He's on his motorbike.
On his bike. Clear off. Swedish QE.
Just a bit more QE, in case the markets hadn't had enough in Europe.
Indeed, which again suggests that economic growth is not quite as entrenched as everyone thought it perhaps was. And Twitter had a pretty problematic week. Some results got released early which weren't quite as palatable as the market had hoped.
Yeah, a mixture of the weaker than expected results and earlier than expected publication of said results.
The irony is somebody tweeted them.
Oh, the irony. We've got the election coming up, and I know it's your first story in 7 days is around the election. I guess we are no closer to knowing what the hell is going on there and what the likely outcome is going to be, and therefore what the implications for the UK stock market are going to be.
You said it all, and I had to remain my very neutrally worded 7 days nib there on the election. No party has demonstrated a clear lead across all the polls. I think everything's still within the margin of error. There's an interesting survey out that I mentioned from St. James's Place, the wealth manager, that kind of just over half of its clients were concerned about the impact of the election. But probably more tellingly, more than 2/3 were concerned about the state of the UK economy. So really, even for the high net worth investor, the economy is looming larger in the mind than the election right now, which probably tells you a little bit about the reaction in the markets or among investors to what's going on. Hasn't been a huge impact yet.
You might cover it in a couple of weeks. We know what's happening. Okay, just talking about tips of the year. I mean, we talked about Barclays, which was the tip of the year. Another tip of the year, Pace, has had a really interesting week. Graham, you might have picked up on this story. Pace, the set-top box maker for cable digital TV, got a takeover bid.
Indeed, it did. Yeah, pretty much a knockout bid, John, worth £2.1 billion from American business Aris. It's a mixture of cash and shares. Pace shares shot up in response. They were still, at the time Daniel wrote this, trading a little bit below the value of the offer, but it's difficult to see a rival bid coming in. But I think Daniel said, wait, you know, just sit on it for now and see what happens.
If it were up to me, I'll take the money. There you go, I'm a coward. Yeah. Okay, thank you for joining us, Mark Robinson. Did you have a nice lunch?
It was a constructive lunch.
Oh, a constructive lunch. Is that what a 2.5-hour lunch is called these days?
Okay, it was very constructive.
Okay, so Mark, you're the star of the show this week because you've launched a new column in this week's magazine.
Well, yeah, it's basically a commodities monthly, and it occurred to me some time ago that we tend to cover commodity stocks on a sort of an ad hoc basis in the magazine, really. So I wanted to sort of bring in a regular update on price trends, really, with that, you know, that our readers will need to, not everyone pours over the reports I do every day.
When I read this, it wasn't quite what I expected, because I only saw it when it was presented to me on page.
It will probably evolve as well.
It will probably evolve. But, you know, I was expecting something perhaps a little bit more sort of plain vanilla. Here's what's happening with prices and here's what may have caused it. But it's a bit more than that, I think.
Yeah, I mean, in this first issue anyway, I've covered a number of what might be termed sort of esoteric stories on the market as well. But with an eye on sort of future trends as well, I mean, that's part of the idea. This isn't sort of looking back, but we're looking where we are in the market and where we might be in a few months' time, perhaps in a few years' time. There's one article in here in particular which I found quite interesting. I can't take any credit for it, obviously, but it was based on a report from Wood Mackenzie, from their chief Asia economist, Cynthia Lim. And it talks about China's westward expansion away from the coastal areas, which have been driving the economy up until now. The thinking is, as China transitions to a more consumer-based economy, that the heavy industry and tertiary industry will move further inland. Mm. And Chinese demographics support this view as well. And of course, Chinese government policy is going to aid the movement of monetary and physical and human capital as well. So it feeds into our general theme that, you know, China is far from being a busted flush, and we might see a secondary growth surge as a result of this. And of course, that can only have positive implications for commodity markets in the future.
Well, I mean, iron ore, I mean, looking at this graph you've got in this week's issue, iron ore has been absolutely hammered. And I guess it's what happens in China that's the main driver of the iron ore price.
Yeah, and nobody's betting for any near-term recovery there at the moment. China had excess steelmaking capacity, which it's gradually reducing. Inventory levels are still sort of on the high side as well. So we're not going to see any real near-term recovery there. And the iron ore miners have obviously taken this into account. BHP, for instance, have put back an expansion project at the Port Hedland export base, and this will reduce near-term capacity growth, and it may encourage other producers to follow suit. One thing that will be supporting the market in the coming months and years as well is that a lot of the second tier iron ore production, a lot of that's endangered because of the dominance and relative cost advantages that BHP, Vale and Rio enjoy at this time.
So basically what we're saying is look out for the low-cost producers, because they're going to be able to survive in what's going to be a constant low-price environment. But the long-term story of economic growth in China as the economy as a whole moves to the interior in terms of the heavy industry,
yeah,
will drive them.
Well, exactly. I mean, that story, I think in the magazine in the past as well, even though there's been a lot of negative talk about Chinese growth prospects, I think we still take the view that, you know, where's growth coming from? It's still an emerging market. So in fact, I've just come from talking to investment bankers, and that's not Cockney rhyming slang either. But they were talking about Chinese capital incursion in Africa as well. And it's still these emerging markets where we're going to see the growth in the future. And speaking from the point of view of someone who's growing tired of secular stagnation, all the strength to it.
Mm. Well, indeed, and this is an argument you've talked about with regards to the oil price as well, that actually energy demand is not falling. And while the oil price may have suffered somewhat due to oversupply, the long-term story for energy, oil, gas is up and up and up.
Yeah, I mean, whoever you speak to, they're generally confident that demand will grow by about a fifth over the next 20 years. And people aren't, okay, unconventional fields are being discovered, large unconventional fields, but readily accessible traditional oil fields. No one's finding any big fields any longer.
Now, what's the oil, Brent crude today? $66 a barrel.
Well, it's ticked up a little bit this week, and the hedge funds are betting on an average price of about $60 a barrel through the remainder of this year. It may well be higher than that,
which I think you predicted a few months back.
Yeah, I was predicting even a little bit higher than that, to be honest.
But still get there.
It may well.
But that's a big move from those lows. I mean, we're talking 30% plus already.
And the significance of this is twofold as well. Obviously, it has advantage of the oil companies themselves. But a period, if companies believe that we're going to see a period of relative stability in oil prices, it's then when they might go on the M&A trial, you know, in the wake of the BG group deal. Mm. But because no one's going to enter when prices are volatile, you know, you can't get buyers and sellers meeting up when the market's like that. So we may begin to see a little bit more consolidation.
Thank you, Mark. I've already noticed the price starting to tick up at the pumps since the oil price has started to rebound from its lows. And that's something that leads us neatly on to your feature this week, Daniel, which is driving cars.
Absolutely.
And the technology that goes into them. One of the biggest things that I think motorists are looking for these days in their vehicles is fuel efficiency.
Yeah, that's one of the trends that's driving growth in the sector at the moment.
Give us an idea about, so, you know, what's happening here. What companies are actually developing this technology, which is making, you know, motoring that much more efficient?
There's been growing concern about air pollution and clean air, and that's become a legislative factor. And basically, there's a lot of engineers involved that have kind of been looking at creating technology to reduce carbon dioxide. Being emitted from these cars. So you have numerous different types of technology. One that springs to mind is Johnson Matthey's made a killing from its catalytic converter technology, which has been around for some time. But I think because the legislation just keeps on evolving, there's just always more opportunities to kind of bring out new technology to fit the latest legislation, because it's just becoming more and more strict.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've just bought a new car, as readers of the magazine will no doubt be painfully aware. But the miles per gallon these things do these days, it's just incredible compared to, you know, a car I had that's 10 years old. I mean, it's, you know, kind of talking double the mileage on these things. And this is really interesting. I guess this is driving the actual car purchasing market as well, which our colleague Julia wrote about in the feature.
Yeah.
So people are very happy to buy a new car because they know that they'll make such a saving on the running costs.
Yeah. Definitely. And, you know, you've got that, and you've also got the kind of all this extra new content and people wanting cars, you know, and they're looking not just for kind of fuel efficiency, but they're also looking for kind of internet stuff.
Yeah.
Infotainment, as they call it.
My new car has a camera that looks out the back. So and it's got little guidelines that tells you how to park the thing. And it's Bluetooth enabled. There's probably more computing power in that than there is in actually my desktop these days. I mean, which companies are benefiting from that aspect of the development of in-car technology?
Well, you've got companies like Laird. There's one company that I talk about, Imagination Technologies, that at the moment I think it's only creates about 5% of its revenues from the auto section.
And we think that's going to rise.
But that's likely to rise. And I think management there are kind of very aware of the opportunities, and they're looking to kind of up their exposure.
Well, one of the things you mentioned in the feature was I thought was really interesting. It really chimed with you know, my decision-making process as a car buyer, was whether I buy a diesel or whether I buy a petrol car. Because, you know, the diesels are perceived to be much more efficient. Obviously, they do a lot more mileage per gallon. But there are increasing worries that actually diesel might not be the most environmentally friendly technology after all, and that new developments in petrol engine technology, might actually render diesel obsolete.
Yeah, that's right. So before, I think there was this big kind of focus on diesel engines producing less carbon dioxide. And lately, there's been some data out that's kind of rejected that claim. There was a study out saying that the emissions caused as many as 60,000 deaths a year in the UK, which is quite worrying. And then you had the French government, which pledged to progressively ban diesel vehicles. So there's been a massive kind of shift in focus now from looking at kind of diesels as being kind of cleaner to actually thinking, hang on a second, they're not so effective in this regard. And so, you know, there's been a worry for companies like Johnson Matthey that they do the catalytic converters.
Yeah, but they do those for petrol cars as well.
Yeah, they do, but they make more money from the diesel side of things because it's a lot more complex. The process is a lot more complex. But as the industry constantly evolves, you know, engineers like that will always find ways to make money and to keep up with whatever demand there is.
Yeah, I mean, actually, one company I've always liked is Ricardo. And they're like a consulting engineer.
Yeah.
And they've been at the forefront of this technology. I mean, they're over 100 years old, their company. Yeah. So they've been in this industry for a long, long time, you know, since the very beginnings. And I presume you've looked at this company in the past. And would you make a Ricardo? I think they're fantastic.
It's a fantastic company. Shares have done really, really well over the past few years. And that's also linked to the fact that they've got this massive focus on green technology.
Yeah.
And that's, like we were saying, that's a massive trend at the moment. You know, there's a massive awareness and focus on kind of how to reduce air pollution.
And I think that's even true. I think that's even true in some of the growth markets like China, which actually is China the biggest single car market in the world now? Which is amazing, really.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you consider actually the proportion of the population that actually drive, it's still quite small overall. So, yeah, I know, you know, that even countries like China that are obviously generally perceived as not having so much of concern over environmental issues do care. And this suggests very big markets for these guys.
Yeah, no, regulation over there is definitely tightening. And, you know, everyone always talks about the pollution there, so that's going to be a massive market to kind of to go for.
One of the other things that I'd not really thought about, which you mentioned in the feature, is motorbikes.
Yeah.
Motorbike. I mean, I know nothing about it. I've never, ever ridden a motorbike, but this is a big market too. And actually, probably not as far down the technological road as cars.
Yeah, no, that's definitely correct. A lot of people are saying that when it comes to like electronical content, for example, there's very little on motorbikes, yet sales are really big. I mean, in kind of developing countries, motorbikes are really, really popular. And there's kind of likely to be this kind of push to make them as sophisticated as cars are. And I think one of the points I'm making in the feature is there's some legislation coming out regarding anti-lock braking systems.
Okay.
That the EU is pushing out from 2016.
Because bikes are involved in quite a lot of accidents.
Yes, exactly. And there's a concern about that. And it's just about kind of making it easier to brake, basically. And that could be a big driver for companies like Victrex. And
Victrex making polymer that goes into the peak braking material.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Imagination Technologies as well have something to do there. So I think it's always very interesting to kind of keep an eye on the kind of latest legislation, because safety is also always a concern in the auto sector. And these companies, you know, they're constantly coming up with new technologies.
Okay. What about driverless cars? They don't sound very safe. I'm a much safer driver than a computer, surely.
I think they're still kind of maybe we'll have to wait a while before that becomes a reality.
You interviewed someone who suggested that the idea that we would have driverless cars on the road in short order was simply not the case. It would be more like 20 to 30 years before the technology had really evolved to the point where A, it was possible, and B, people trusted it.
Yeah, definitely.
But I mean, there will be aspects of computerized driving that will come in much more quickly than that.
Yeah, I think that's the point. I mean, without kind of getting too carried away, there's gradually various kind of technologies that kind of take parts of that and are being used already. And there's talk about things like automated collision avoidance, lane change correction, deceleration tools, those kind of things that are really kind of driving safety in cars. And they're kind of growing things that we are expecting to appear gradually over the next few years.
Auto limiters sounds interesting. So regulating the speed at which cars can drive in certain areas, I think, I mean, that sounds like a very, very good idea.
Yeah.
People still speed.
Yeah.
And it's obviously speeding in, you know, pedestrianised areas that causes enormous amounts of accidents still. Okay, well, thanks, Daniel. It's a fascinating feature, and it's really well illustrated. I know you went to great lengths to produce this diagram about which companies are involved in all aspects of the production of a car. It's fantastic.
Yeah, and no, I hope you really enjoy it.
Good. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so thank you, everyone, again, for your contributions this week. Thank you, Ian. Thank you, Mark, for joining us eventually. It's a great first start to the Commodities Monthly. I think we'll, in a market which is very much a market for contrarians at the moment, I think you've got to know these off-the-beaten-track stories. And thank you, Graham, over on the desk there.
Thank you, John.
Lots in the magazine this week. We've got a feature from our regular contributor, Anthony Garner, who's talking through how investors can basically get started in quant investing. And he's talking through some of the tools that are available there that private investors can access to really help you backtest some sort of theoretical models that you have. Talking to tools, Algie Hall's taken a bit of a departure in this week's stock screen. He's reviewed a new product from our friends over at Ionic Information, SharePad, which is the web-enabled equivalent of ShareScope. And he's used their stock screening filters there to show you readers. And it's a regular question that we have, how you can replicate what Algie does. He's given you some pointers as to how you may be able to achieve that with ShearPad. And our trader, Nicole Elliott, has taken a look at the Hound of Hounslow and what he was actually doing. I'm sure we've all enjoyed the front pages that have been generated by this story, but what Nicole has done is used her very, very deep experience of trading and the futures markets to explain exactly what he's accused of doing. It's a fascinating read. Lots more in the magazine, the usual tips, results, comments, and obviously we'll be doing a personal finance podcast this week too, so I will leave them to discuss that. Thank you very much again for your time. Pick up the magazine, £4.50 in all good newsagents. You'll recognise it by the sort of futuristic Knight Rider car bonnet type thing on the cover this week. Thanks again, everybody, and see you next week. Goodbye.